does it for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Kevin Pina and Miguel Gavilan Molina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 10 o'clock. Coming up next, it's Between the Covers. David Naiman interviews poet Rob Schlegel about his book, In the Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps.
I've been a rambler all my romping, roving days. A railroad boy with nothing for to do.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society 2019-20 concert season. Bill Staines is the featured artist for the upcoming October 11 concert. Bill Staines is a singer-songwriter whose career has spanned five decades, and his songs have been recorded by many well-known artists. That's Bill Staines in concert, Friday, October 11 at 7:30 p.m. at the Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steele Street in Portland. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Ace, there you are. Take off your coat. Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is the poet Rob Schlegel. Schlegel is the author of The Lesser Fields from the Center of Literary Publishing, selected by James Loganbach for the Colorado Prize for Poetry, and January Machine from Four Way Books, selected by Stephanie Burt for the Grub Street National Book Prize. His poetry has appeared in the Iowa Review, Boston Review, Poetry, Columbia Poetry Review, and elsewhere. A graduate of Linfield College and the University of Montana with an MFA in poetry, Rob Schlegel has taught both at Whitman College and in the MFA program at Portland State University, and is also co-editor with Daniel Popik and Rowan Al-Khatib of the Catenary Press, a press dedicated to designing and constructing handmade poetry chapbooks. Rob Schlegel is here today to talk about his latest collection, In the Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps, from University of Iowa Press and selected by Brenda Shaughnessy for the Iowa Poetry Prize. Recipient of Publishers Weekly's Starred Review, Mary Shebist says this about In the Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps. Precise and nuanced, this lyric journey is at once fable, field guide, confession, and thrilling meditative adventure. I know of no poet quite so gifted as Rob Schlegel at chronicling the way impulse turns over the mind. Shane McRae says, In the Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps is dominated by three of the most remarkable long poems I've read in years, and quietly elicits a great clamor of feeling. And Brenda Shaughnessy says that Rob Schlegel has a voice you'd follow into the dark woods, knowing full well it's hard, awful, daily, plain living truth you're running toward. The speaker in this book is a heartbreaker of a storyteller, a synesthesiac of mixed feelings, bad news, and wordsmithery. I feel known, caught out, believed in, vulnerable when I read this book. Welcome to Between the Covers, Rob Schlegel.
Thanks.
So you once described your book prior to this one, January Machine, as beginning at the intersection of Walt Whitman's democratic pluralism and George Oppen's shipwreck of the singular. And I love that description, partially because of the tension of intersecting or juxtaposing these two very different impulses and aesthetics. And I guess I was curious how you might describe In the Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps in this regard, because I do feel, as the term double sex might suggest, a bringing together, perhaps, or a blurring of distinctions between things that might be seen otherwise as opposites.
I'm always uncomfortable thinking about using the universal we, which Whitman seemed so comfortable doing. And this book, the most recent book, has felt like a more personal engagement with the lyric I, or a more immediate, almost private relationship with the lyric I, which seems to me a little bit more closely aligned with Oppen's The Shipwreck of the Singular. I don't feel shipwrecked in this book. I feel a little bit more buoyed by the possibility of likeness with others. Those others including friends, family, and people who want to be seen for who they are.
Well, you've said about this collection, the meaning I'm trying to protect is that the heart is neither boy nor girl. And you've described the book as a search for the mother and the father, the poet and the parent, the forest and the human. And I want to go into each of these at some point in our conversation today. But before we do, I was hoping we could start with a reading of the introductory poem of the collection, Show Cave, which also has a title that is surprising, with two words that seem to work against each other and somehow at the same time enhance each other.
Show Cave. It begins with hide and seek in the cave spring air warms. Why, even the dogwoods shed blossoms over the dead sculpture garden where the oracle speaks on behalf of the gods. Near the fountain, a few deer, rich with insides different from mine, but the same, incorporated as I am, though wired to nothing. I fold leaves into swans, rearrange the trees. The oracle touches my face. Language is where you live in mere fidelity to narrative, she says. But language is not my first language.
Before we talk about the mother and in the father, or the poet and the parent, it feels like the book wants us to experience the world of the child in relation to language. The oracle tells us that language is where you live in mere fidelity to narrative, but language is not our first language. And quickly in the next poem, we are placed in the point of view of a child. And I guess I wanted to hear your thoughts about the wisdom of the oracle, about language and narrative versus our first language, and what you are reaching for in this regard.
Yeah, I think I was reaching for some kind of acknowledgement in language that language is deceiving, and therefore what I think I was trying to do seems impossible, because I'm using the very medium to try to come to some kind of understanding about the impossibility of the medium. I guess children are like petri dishes for language, and they're trying things on all the time to figure out the boundaries of language and what it can do for them and what it can't do for them. So language is always new to a child. As a father, I've been able to witness this firsthand over the past 9 years, and it's certainly freeing for a child to become more comfortable using language, but it's also, language is also dangerous because it can get you into trouble. Mm-hmm. So it's a double-edged sword.
Well, I wanted to ask you about your aesthetic in light of your poetry, reaching for our first language before language. You had a conversation with John Jameson, Bomb Magazine, where he says, I hardly know anyone who writes stranger and more vivid poems than Rob Schlegel. They have a way of subtly tweaking a world that seems at first familiar, but that is revealed to be utterly disassociative. His poems are grounded in the real, in a trenchant observation of material and of mundane reality, but they force his readers to confront the ontological categories that structure experience and to, gently, lovingly, like a mare to her foal, tear those categories apart. These poems blur the lines between knowable and known, material and transcendence, between signifier, signified, and what's lost therein. It turns out quite a lot. In The Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps reduces objects to mere matter, freeing them of conceptual signification and rendering them raw and new. Such estrangement begets its own clarity. And then similarly, you've said, and I really love this line, you've said, I want my poetry to be made of language that is somehow so immediate in its transmission that it feels like an electrical impulse. But I also want the language to be aware of its own impossibility. I think this is related to the signified signifier dilemma inherent in every utterance. Don't most poets write to change the shape of the brain and the heart? So I was hoping you would talk about the desire to change the shape of the brain and the heart. And in the world of the poet on the page, what considerations you use in trying to create a pulse or an impulse on the page in language that somehow goes around it.
Yeah, that's the impossible task. I guess I feel like the best poems are not derivative of experience, but they are their own experience. And for the reader, they're their own experience, which means that for me, writing them is a way to possibly change the shape of the brain and the heart, so that as I use the material of language, my own understanding of the internal structure of the brain and the heart, the soul, the consciousness, is transformed. And the more attentive I am to every utterance, to every syllable, both as I speak and as I write, I think the more alive those actual organs inside my body feel. And that's, I think, what appeals to me so much about poetry.
Well, I want to maybe push on that idea more. I like how Mary Sheba's praise of the book, she highlights how you chronicle the way impulse turns over the mind, rather than a mind thinking about an impulse. It's the reverse. It's an inversion, and as if the pulse is both leading and reshaping the mind. And that reminds me of the brain being in the heart in your conception of it. And it made me wonder if this was connected to something that you described as one of your most pivotal moments as a writer. So you said that in graduate school, the poet Forrest Gander read one of your poems and said, "It looks like you're pretty comfortable working in this mode. Maybe it's time to pull up the flowers and plant something more difficult to grow." And you said that since then you've been hyper diligent about not allowing either the form, tone, or content of your work to become too comfortable. So I was wondering how that looked, how you do that, what ways you employ to push yourself out of the box, and also whether that attempt to not be comfortable is somehow connected to creating the impulse or the pulse, or whether those are just two separate things entirely.
I should first attribute that sentence from Forrest Gander to James Schuyler, which is where I think he said that it came from also. And that impulse seems to me to manifest itself in a continual kind of pressure that I put on things like syntax and diction and form. And some of that pressure, I think, is informed by things that I read, obviously, and also by comments that I get from readers, friends who are readers. And I had a fairly formative experience sort of auditing a class at Iowa with the poet Jeffrey G. O'Brien, who was teaching a course on form called The End of the Poem. And it certainly reshaped the way that I think about form and poetry, and made me more attentive to choices that I make. I didn't want to write a book of obvious sonnets in January Machine, so I tried to write instead a sequence of sonnets that felt concealed, like they were hiding from themselves as sonnets. And then that were also interrupted by these moments of static when the form started to feel rote, or it started to feel repetitious. The form would sort of break down into these moments of stasis, and I would write these very brief couplets. There would be two couplets per poem that would somehow feel like a new charge or a new sort of electrical impulse or pulse that got me into the next sonnet. And those moments of static come about three quarters of the way through the book after my relationship with those sonnets started to feel belabored.
And were there similar ways in which you did that in the new collection, that maybe at some point you see yourself repeating yourself in a way that feels like you're too much in a groove?
The new collection structurally as a collection feels very different from January Machine, which I considered one long poem interrupted by these moments of stasis. There are times when I look at In the Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps and I think, oh, I could almost read this as a kind of a sequence, in the sense that there's this voice at the beginning that seems relatively consistent and moves through these scenes and events and internal landscapes and exterior landscapes and finds themselves to be somewhere else at the end of the book. But I don't know. I think that the consistency within this new book is the long poems, the sequences, the three sequences that feel like touchstones within each section of the book. The book is broken into three sections, and each section contains a long poem that feels like sort of a foundation.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Rob Schlegel about In the Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps. Well, I want to talk about the first long poem and also connect it to the lyric eyes that you brought up, the questions of selfhood and also of persona. So if we look at Show Cave, the poem that you read, and the long poem Novella, that is the poem that anchors the first third, there are a lot of blurring of distinctions. The rich insides of the deer are both different and the same as us. Leaves of trees are folded into swans. Acorn and wild apple or quince or egg of quail are growing in the child's throat. A bee emerges from a calf's mouth and becomes an owl, which then delivers a prophecy. The child imagines himself as a flock of sheep and wonders if the lemon also tastes him. So identity seems porous. the world magical and wondrous, and the way of moving through it communal and seemingly forever reinventing itself. And this interrogation of identity or selfhood, it feels like, goes back into your previous collections. For instance, the lines in January Machine, I see my face in the face of others, and I am the I undone, immersed in perspective, and the difficulty of remaining one person. Or in your first collection, each day I tried to give myself a different name. So I wanted to ask you about this troubling of identity in relationship to the lyric I and persona, because you said that this first long poem, novella, feels central to the mythology of your life as a poet, and that it is almost a persona poem. So talk to us about that.
Yeah. So this poem began as a 50-page long poem that was the next thing I wrote after January Machine. I was working in the mode of these long poems that felt like book-length projects or whatever. And I began writing that poem after reading Flaubert's Three Tales, which includes this story, The Legend of St. Julian the Hospitader, which is about a young boy who kills a mouse in church and then becomes this really excellent hunter and ends up slaughtering all these deer in a forest. And a stag essentially approaches the young boy and curses him that one day he'll kill his parents. And he spends the rest of the story is essentially the boy avoiding that fate until he can't avoid it any longer. And I'm not going to give away the ending because it's a remarkable short story and everyone should go read it. I was transfixed by that story. I could not stop thinking about it. And so I felt like I needed to write my way into that obsession. So I wanted to think about my own experience with language as a kind of proxy for animals. What acts of violence was I committing with language that was equivalent to this boy in Flaubert's short story killing these animals? And it seemed to me like I could maybe begin to answer that question in a 50-page long poem. But I couldn't, because there were a lot of, I think, distractions, and I don't think I was up to the task. Or I could, and that is another book for a different time. Essentially, long story short, that 50 pages was sort of crystallized into this much shorter poem that feels like it draws from my own life and relationship with my parents, as well as having another foot in this myth that Flaubert told so beautifully.
Well, in the poetry workshop you taught at Portland State, you began the syllabus with a quote by Alan Grossman, part of which goes, "Insofar as love wills the existence of what it loves, the principle of poetry is a collective and perpetually renewed act of love that brings the world to mind and mind to mind as the speech of a person at the moment of the vanishing of world and persons, which is every moment of conscious life." To me, this feels like a koan, or a productive koan. And you take this quote as a launching point to pose some questions to your students, such as, to what degree does a poet exhibit her own presence in a poem, does human quote-unquote presence require an identifiable speaker? How does the poem bring quote-unquote the world to mind through description and quote-unquote mind to mind through form? And I wonder if hearing Grossman's quote and your own words read back to you, if that sparks anything in relationship to this project and this project approaching a persona poem for you.
It does. It feels like if I'm thinking about the trajectory of this speaker in novella and the way in which that speaker changes throughout this book, I can see how there's a kind of self-mythology that dominates the first section of this book. And as the book unfolds, that mythology changes and maybe transforms into something that I'm tempted to call more real, but I think that that formulation, or more realistic, or more rooted in daily life, but I think that that formulation can be limiting. But it does feel like I wrote my way out of a myth and toward a more clear-eyed understanding of what it means to be a parent, a poet, a spouse, a friend, a brother, a son. And Flaubert's short story somehow gave me access to that realization. So mind to mind is maybe my mind to Flaubert's, and or my mind to his character's mind, the young boy who is given this dark, dark prophecy, or my mind to the deer's mind, or the oracle's mind.
I was hoping maybe we could end with one last poem from the collection. If we could hear Wind Rings a Bell the Wind Can't Reach.
Wind rings a bell the wind can't reach. The animal, you know, throws itself against a mirror. You leave before the smear. Your parents are waiting up for you. You can feel the weight of invisible forces pressing you into a boy or girl with a taste for leaves, colors, lines you move within against labels' threat. But you know there is this other world inside anatomy's swoon, semi-formal, burning with dissent. You whisper to the tree, the murmuring tree. You might take action. Sun melts snow into streams, increasing in volume you control with your lips around history. Your eyes meet. Your invisible dress threatens a slow death. The rest you want to carry, so you listen to the tree and its never quite obsolete magic. Touch your mouth. Touch your mouth if it's bleeding, if you didn't see it coming. Be small in the antique hour, in the ambient barbed wire. Stand up. Act like a man. Act like a man is the story of fortune. Act like a woman. Act like a woman is the story of woman. Raise your hand. Raise your hand, your child. Your child has a dagger. If you don't love her, she'll use it. Touch your face. Touch your face. There you are. Take off your coat. Take off your shoes, your socks. Take off your shirt. Fly into evening's flawed divinity. land in the tree where the double sex sleeps. Sleep. The invincible summer's inside you.
Thanks for being on the show today, Rob.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking today to Rob Schlegel, the author of In the Tree Where the Double Sex Sleeps from the University of Iowa Press. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Coming up next on Words and Pictures, SW Konser speaks with Jared Souza, Portland-based writer and illustrator.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor in Evening with Ken Stringfellow on Saturday, October 19th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Hollywood Senior Center in Portland. Ken Stringfellow, founding member of the Posies, performs songs from his 30-year career as a musician. This night features songs and stories from his work as a solo artist, as well as Neil Young, Big Star, Robin Hitchcock, and much more. Again, that's an evening with Ken Stringfellow on Saturday, October 19th from 7 to 9 at the Hollywood Senior Center, 1820 Northeast 40th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. So
welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm S.W. Konser, and today I'm joined by a comics artist, an illustrator of children's books, a